We're here at the Q Report, live from Roberta's in Bushwick. I'm here with Ed Grant.
Hey, how you doing, man? Good afternoon to you.
This is Mark Morabella. Patrick will be joining us shortly, for all you Patrick fans out there. Beautiful day here. Today's show is on the Q Report, the quotidian, everyday culture, all the time. Today's show, we have three fantastic guests, actually more than three guests, three guests in three segments. And the show today is everything spectacle.
Yeah, we have somebody who works with one of probably the most prestigious museums in the world. We have a filmmaker, well, a cameraman. What would you call him? What would Peter be?
Director of photography.
Director of photography. And we also have return guest, Molly Ward, and she's brought along some of her cast members.
Yeah, that fantastic play that's playing on Broadway in Brooklyn, on Broadway. Off Broadway.
Yep.
In the borough of Brooklyn.
Yep.
So it's everything spectacle. I mean, it's pretty interesting. All these different arts are all about the visual arts, the physical spaces that people are designing. Peter, who I've worked with for many years, I've known. Actually, I was trying to think of it between Patrick and Peter. I've known Patrick just a little bit longer, but in the same way, Patrick.
Hi, baby.
Patrick, I've known longer than Peter, which I was surprised by, but as just mere babes in the woods, and look what they've done with their lives. Fantastic. So Peter is a cameraman for, I've worked with him a lot of my documentaries, as well as, and most famously, he works on Amazing Race. As he likes to say, he, you know, whatever they do on Amazing Race, he has to do it backwards and in focus. And likewise,
that's like worse than a tour guide who has to walk backwards. He has to film it.
He has to film it and not trip and stay in focus.
I have such a good question for him about The Amazing Race. I cannot wait.
He's done even a more. I don't know if you're familiar with the documentary Blindsight, but it was released last year and it's doing okay. But it's gotten awards. It was at Tribeca, but it's all about these blind Tibetan children who were climbing Mount Everest, and so he climbed Mount Everest backwards there too. I mean, like in, you know, oxygen deprived. And him carrying a camera. So it's a very physical, it's artistic, it's also very physical.
Yeah, that camera is not at all light to be
running
around with.
There's a lot of running in that show.
Yeah.
I mean, he'll talk about the rules of how that it works, but it's amazing. I mean, from a production standpoint, producing television shows, I don't know how they do it. It's unbelievable because they have to go everywhere and make sure it's all, you know.
Yeah, but, you know, and with our whole thing, though, you know, with spectacle, you know, everybody that we'll be talking to is very serious about their work and their art and their craft. But ultimately, for them to continue, the public has to be entertained. And we're not saying that in a derogatory way, but museums...
Or fascinated.
Yeah, but museums, you know, they do the blockbuster shows to get the foot traffic in, ratings for television.
Right,
you know,
that's right.
Box
and
office.
And word of mouth for the place.
What do they call it? What is that week called when everyone is going to be doing the ratings? They call it Crunch Week or something? Or
Sweeps.
Which is a total, you know, that's something, talking about a documentary, one of my friends was going to do that. I mean, that's another total sham, the whole idea of, like, ratings. I mean, they hang a hat on that stuff, but it's really, it's barely true.
Those are decisions by a bunch of board of directors in Texas boardrooms.
Are you saying that they're not long for this world? They aren't really, because of course
they're already carrying dead on the side of the road.
They don't want to. It's obvious because if people are online now and with cable boxes, it's quite simple to see what channels are being watched for how long. But they don't want to do that because, you know. Do you know how they do the ratings still?
Yeah,
they give notebooks to families. I mean, can you imagine like having? I mean, just anybody out there. By the way, no one's ever actually knows a Nielsen family.
Yeah, I've never met anybody.
Nobody's ever met.
And I do know a Nielsen. I know a Chris Nielsen in Santa Cruz, California.
But he's not part of the Nielsen.
He's not part of
the
Nielsen.
He doesn't have a box.
He's about space. He's an architect.
You know, it's so crazy. The other big scam, which maybe we shouldn't talk about in today's show, besides Nielsen's, is scaffolding. People can implant a pig heart into a human in 8 hours, but they cannot clean the facade of a New York City building in a year.
It's so true. It's true.
I mean, it is beyond a scam. Like, when one opens up on your block, you're like, it's not as nice a block.
Yeah, well, it's true. Oh, actually, I have to say, you know.
If you have a business, it's like, I don't mind the rain, having the being covered by the rain, though.
Well, interestingly enough, our first guest, Michael Lapthorne, from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, has a scaffolding story, sort of. You know, that on Fifth Avenue, very prestigious area. The people across from the museum are rich and used to getting their way. And Michael, you have a story about a woman who was, you know, all angry and all for the work you guys were doing on the facade.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some neighbors across the across Fifth Avenue that like to, you know, protect what they see from their view, and there's a lot of exterior work going on, cleaning the facade. And
what on the museum?
Yeah, on the, this was a while ago. This was about 3 years ago. And
for those who don't know, we're talking about the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is in the Upper East Side and Fifth Avenue.
On Fifth Avenue,
right. Michael, you're right. Actually, Patrick,
I grew up on 80th between 81st and 82nd on Madison, right next to Frank Campbell's, the funeral parlor.
Oh, really? Wow.
So my dandy Denmont Terrier has taken about maybe 3,000 dumps on your property.
And you picked up at least 295 of those, right?
Yeah, they washed it all off. No, it took them a while.
Just quick thing. My mom used to take me to see Robin Williams do the mime act. He was one of the mimes in front, I guess the early 70s,
mid-70s.
That's
a long time ago.
I've never seen a mime there.
Now we've kind of.
That's they washed him away with the scaffolding.
That's right. Now, we had to do all sorts of things. We had to cover it. We had to paint it. We had to move it. We had to remove it and then put it back up again. It's just, there's a lot of people, there with a lot of money and a lot of spare time. Yep. And they can make, it can make as much or as little trouble as they feel like that day.
Yeah.
So,
Michael, tell us your title. Tell us what you do.
Well, I'm an exhibition designer at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Fascinating.
Thank you. My focus really is on capital project, large scale, working with architects to work on the permanent spaces. There's a team of exhibition designers that work on the special exhibitions that come through, but I work. My experience has been with architects and very, very expensive sort of installations.
Like so, what, for instance?
Well, I started, I worked on the Greek and Roman courtyard, trying to integrate the art into the architecture. It's not as simple a matter as it would appear on drawings when you get them.
Especially when you're carrying around marble slabs, right?
That's right. Well, luckily I don't have to do the carrying.
No, you stand around and point.
I stand around and point
but
a lot.
Still.
What, do they have a high-low?
Oh, they've got you name it, they have it. They got a team of riggers that whose sole job is to move heavy stuff and hang it on the wall. And to hang it on the wall, you got to have the steel. And to put the steel in the wall, you got to have the engineer. And to have the engineer, you have to have the architect somewhere to put this. You know, it's a very, very involved process. So the more time you can get a head start, the better off you'll be.
You had kind of a large hand in the floor for the Roman Gallery, no?
Not really. I was in favor of the floor the way it is now. It's very at first sight when it was first installed. It was kind of shocking how vibrant I should say how the marbles are very, very
shimmery.
Shimmery. Yeah, there's a lot of activity in them, and people were sort of scratching their heads wondering if we made the right decision. But once you balance that with a lot of white marbles and gray pedestals, it tends to really
it does really pop out. For those who haven't seen the it's really large scale, gigantic. I mean, describe the room and the space. I mean, just to give people who haven't been there, or maybe they want to go.
Well, it used to be the old cafeteria. Which had that big center court with those big columns.
Yeah, it's a beautiful space, actually.
It was literally ripped completely apart.
How high is the ceiling now?
Well, the ceiling, I mean, there's an atrium that's, maybe 50 feet with a sort of, big skylight. And so the interior court was completely restored. It's now flush with the circle or the peristyle that went around the court. So it's all one level. And then above that will be the new Islamic galleries. And then above that, there used to be attic space. And now there's two separate floors of office space. So the Met is fully circumscribed now by the park. They can't build anything on to the Met anymore. So a lot of this is space recovery from inside. It's a very unique way of looking at it. For instance, the American wing. If you remember the old installation, there was a lot of ramps and brick and plants and stuff. And we actually excavated 18 feet down into the Manhattan bedrock schist.
What?
That's incredible. You created a whole new floor, huh?
Under. It used to be, the floor used to be on brick.
Oh, that's where the cafeteria is, right?
Well, right. So it used to be on grade, meaning
I didn't remember that. Yeah. When I went down there, I was like, I didn't remember this room being there. It was beautiful though, actually.
Well, now there's 12,000 square feet under the mat where there didn't used to be anymore. So, which is, from what I understand, is a popular way of gaining real estate for people whose houses go down.
Right. And you're not allowed to go up, right?
Yeah.
For the most part, either.
No. Very interesting.
Manhattan, they're usually going up. That's interesting.
Yeah. Exactly. So the building, as you see it, is going to stay that way until landmarks changes or something like that.
I was just going to ask a one sentence question. Now, what percentage of the Met's art is actually on display, and what percentage of it is actually hidden in caverns and things?
That's a good question. I don't actually really know. I would say, well, you see, when you talk about the number of objects the Met has, a lot of them are like, you know, as big as the head of a pin, but, you know, they still considered accessioned objects. And so there's, I would say, a huge percentage of those that the Met has that really aren't worth much of anything. They just happen to have them, and they have numbers, and you have to keep track of them in the same way, and they have some value, but... Mm-hmm. I don't even know that I could feel a number.
But there's more unseen.
Oh, there's lots. I mean, for instance, prints and drawings. You have to cycle those constantly because light will wear them down. So you have to rotate them constantly. And so there's a huge number of drawings. Just, you know, the nature of the material, you can have a lot more drawings, and you can have oil paintings. You know, finished.
Where is it all stored?
All over the place. There's storage rooms hidden behind doors that you'd never know were there until someone walked out. They're stored various locations around the state. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have storage spaces up in Upper Manhattan.
Yeah, you have the cloisters and...
Cloisters.
Oh, yeah. Is that part of the Met, technically? Yeah, I forgot.
Oh, yeah,
that's
it's
right.
definitely part that's of the
right.
Met.
Who's your new curator now? I mean, it used to be Montalbano, right?
Oh, it used to be Philippe de Montebello as the director. And now we have a new director, Thomas Campbell, who's
nice
new,
guy.
Taking over. New reign of terror is
like
about
him?
To begin. It's like,
do you like him?
He's a great guy. He's got quite a job ahead. I mean, he took this position at just the hardest moment, which gives him some advantages and some big disadvantages. But... I think the Met is going to be...
His first 100 days is allowed to be first 150 days because of the biggest economic recession.
That's about right.
Well, we'll take a quick break and we'll come right back with this fascinating subject.
Welcome back, everyone. This is the Q Report with myself, Ed, and my good friend Patrick.
Hello.
And Mark, the cranky filmmaker.
That's me.
We don't have a sound effect for cranky.
Yeah, that's me sniffling with my allergies. Yeah.
So,
that's kind of cranky.
Lone wolf? Yeah, I'm a lone wolf.
Yeah, definitely a lone wolf. So we're speaking with Michael Lapthorne, an exhibition designer at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And upcoming this week on Tuesday is the unveiling grand opening of the American Wing that's gone through some serious renovation and, I guess, dirt digging. So, Michael, what are, like, the processes? I mean, this took, what, 6, 7, 8, 10 years? I would say
from the first realization that something has to be done, it was probably, you know, eight or nine years ago. And it's just a question of sitting down and kind of making a list of what you want to see. Like, there's a lot of big pieces of art sort of tend to drive the process. You say, I want these giant marble statues to move here. And that requires a lot of extra things. It requires steel in the floor. It requires cranes, meaning that you have to do things in a certain order. You have to open up the curtain wall so you can let the crane in. And then you have to get the crane out before you do other things. So, and other things like we wanted to move stained glass windows that previously were had their backs to Central Park up where they would feel more appropriate on the second floor, as one would see in a church, perhaps. You know, there's a certain
more light too.
Perceived light. It's actually not exterior light, but it would give the sense that the light was coming from outside. Mm-hmm. So then you have to sink those. You have to sink the light box into the architecture, and the Met is a very organic. It was built piece by piece and building by building, and there's always a mystery
when you
open it up again to see what's there. And in fact, there were huge pieces of granite cornice from the third extension of the Met that had to be had to be cut off with a giant saw.
That you had no idea was there until you
opened
the wall.
We knew it was there because we know what the other side looks like, because the other side of the building is the Petrie Court. So you run across the building and you take your measurements on the other side, and then you can transfer those to the other side. And you can say, okay, well, I know there's a window opening here, so I can run power and data through this window.
Right.
And, I mean, it's literally a window.
How big is the Met in total? I mean, it's hard to tell because it's in the park, and the park is so big, but is it, like, more than a block? Is it?
It's 12 square blocks.
Oh, my.
So from my office.
That's crazy.
Yeah, from my office.
That's just stretching. That's not even up and down, right? That's just, like, one.
That's not vertical transportation at all.
Holy
yeah. So
cow.
If I walk from my office to the American Wing, it's like walking from 79th Street to 85th Street.
Wow.
Back and forth.
There's just that logistics alone.
Wow,
I mean,
yeah.
I meant to get a pedometer and calculate the number of miles that I never did.
I always wonder why you're so thin.
Well, plus the fact that when the elevator was being installed, the stairs were the only way up and down. And
even with all your secret passageways and shortcuts, it's still a hike.
Yeah, are there a lot of secret passageways and stuff?
There are, and they're always. And I've been there. I'm a youngster when it comes to the Met. I've only been there 4 years, and I'm constantly surprised when one of my colleagues pops out of a wall. It's one of the exciting things about working at the Met is, I mean, you really get a sense that you can really duck behind a wall or something.
Because that's really one of the old buildings in America, probably. I mean, at least the foundation of it, no?
Well, that's the thing is that it's not a building. It's actually, I forget the number, but it's like 24 separate buildings, each with their own foundations, with HVAC. When I say organic, I mean truly it's an organism.
Right.
And it has to be balanced. And if you make one change here, then it can affect something in an adjoining part of the museum. It's all a very, very careful balancing act, not through the fault of engineers in particular, but it's just it's something that's been built onto and rebuilt, and you just have to do your best to keep track of it all and just try and make it all work.
And of course, while you're doing all this work, the museum's open, so you have visitors.
Yeah.
You have the other art. I know you close off sections, but still.
I feel bad for visitors when they show up and then, you know, half the museum is closed because Mondays are very, very busy days for us, because those are the only days that are closed to the public. And when people come up to stairs and they say Monday's closed, and they walk, you know, behind the front door, we're just going flat out, basically, to get all the work that we should be doing during business hours on a Monday. Mondays are very important. So,
has it been the Met opened? What has it been, more than a century?
Yeah, in fact,
was it one of the
1880s?
Was it private trust that established it? Wasn't it? Was it?
Yeah, I mean, all of these, all the grand New York institutions are funded by private individuals. J.P. Morgan was really the one who kind of.
It was his initial collection, wasn't it, that started?
Well, yes, parts of it, and then
robber barons all on the backs of like train guys in Pittsburgh or something, and then we get all these beautiful cultural icons.
Well, Morgan was the banker, so he needed the money.
Yeah.
He needed a place that could contain his nose.
They needed his money. He was the banker.
Yeah. So, Michael, I do have one very important question.
Yes.
When is the Islamic Wing going to reopen? It was my favorite part of the museum. It's been shut for years.
It's a difficult question. If you go to Fifth Avenue today, you will see a scaffold being erected through which material will be delivered to the Islamic floor, which is directly above the Greek and Roman floor. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be a very tight material delivery system, I guess you could say. But the scaffolding has started, the elevator is going to go up, the lift is going to go in, and it's a raw space now. Right. So all it just has to be sort of filled in.
Good. I'm looking forward to it.
I think that exhibition is going to explode.
That's probably Thank not you. The choicest sound effect.
That was my one contribution to the show.
We'll continue on.
Oh, right. That's not the kind of... No, I did not mean that. I just meant it's going to take off.
Okay. Yeah, you're sounding like me for a minute there.
Jeez. Well, this is fascinating. Yeah. Would you come back on maybe a couple times and give us updates?
Especially
for
the Islamic
things?
Wing. Yeah. Sure. We want to hear about how it's going and what kind of stuff you got and how you're schlepping it up the steps.
And the American Wing opens this Tuesday for the first time.
Tuesday to the public. Well, we're calling it the new American Wing. I think when you walk in, you'll scratch your head and say, this looks familiar, yet different. Mm. And
it still has the facade of the White House.
Oh yeah, the bank facade. Diana, the gold statue, is still in the middle.
Okay.
Tiffany glass is all around, but the floor is
18 feet deeper.
Well, no. That's the story. That's the new floor below, which you won't see. That's storage and all that other stuff. But it's all one level now. So all the sculpture, which previously you couldn't get to because there was plants between you and it. Now you can get around it.
Excellent.
You can, and it's really more of a dedicated place to enjoy sculpture and all the dimensions instead of just at a distance.
Sweet.
So.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for coming in.
Yeah, next time I want to ask you about the whole bidding wars, like when there's a piece of art out there like Tutankhamun's sarcophagus. Who gets it? I mean, does the Louvre fight with the Met? But that's for another story. Yeah, but,
and also about what happens when things break. But coming up next will be Peter Sickert, director of photography.
For Amazing Race.
The Amazing Race, The Amazing Race, The Amazing Race. I cannot wait to ask.
Patrick, are you going to be a contestant someday?
It's the only reality show I've seen. I've seen it 3-4 times, and it's the only one I can bear, but I think it's fascinating.
I think we're going to pair up, me and you.
All right. Oh, God.
Good TV.
What, we would never leave the hotel room.
No, we would argue about which way to go. Michael Laphorn has left the studio. Yeah, well, that was fascinating. I the Met is one of those institutions that, I guess as New Yorkers you walk by, that's one of those excuses like, oh yeah, we're going to go to the museums, and I haven't been there in a while, but now I'm really interested to go back.
It's one of the few museums I'd like to go to often, I mean maybe once a year, but still it's like, as opposed to the Modern or the Guggenheim, which I only go to if there's a show I have to see.
The cool thing with the Met too is that it has so many different rooms, and
it's a new place every time you go in there.
It's really beautiful.
Like I was saying with the Islamic Wing, one, it used to always be empty. no one there. And you'd walk into these recreated rooms that the woodwork and stuff was exquisite, and you could be alone and really enjoy it.
It's really important now for that wing to be open because of everybody's...
Who aren't going to go anywhere.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, so we're back at the Q Report as we're rambling on. We have our next guest here, Peter Sickhart, director of photography, a dear old friend of mine, a current friend.
How you doing?
Hey, Peter.
So Peter and I have worked together for a long time in many shows, but Peter... you're originally from... Actually, you still are from Prague, technically. You're not changed.
I'm very much from Prague.
From the Czech Republic. Tell us about... I really wanted to hear you talk a little bit about the Velvet Revolution, which is really interesting to me. And, because you were kind of there as the youth as it was happening and came over to the States right after that. I mean, it's a pretty interesting... I don't know if you want to get into the Pittsburgh Gazette at all, but that's a pretty interesting story about the Velvet Revolution in Prague. Can you talk about that at all, being in the streets?
Well, it was a lot of fun. We were 15, 16-year-old kids, and we're just about in the age when we kind of understood that the whole communism and the system was just completely flawed, and nobody was telling the truth. And we wanted to do something about it. I mean, what could you do when you're 15?
You get drunk, you get high, and you take down the Soviet Union.
Basically, that's what we did.
Is that all it took?
They did it first in 69. They did it first in 68. And
but
then
what happened was it didn't really work in 68, yeah. So that was the bummer. So right. Our parents were kind of like, don't do this, you're crazy. It's just going to be right, like it was when we were kids. So we drank a lot of
beer.
Sorry
they said that now. It ended up working, huh?
Somehow, I don't know. We did things like ran down the street of political prisoners, and it was pretty serious. You could get arrested for that. But we went to all kinds of demonstrations, got beaten up by the communist police, by the riot police. We didn't really know what we were doing, but it was fun. One of my favorite stories was one of my dear friends, Andrew from Prague. He always said, well, I never really wanted to go with you guys, but it was this girl that I liked.
Of course.
Andrew.
So it's like
the famous Andrew.
So I went anyway, and next thing the revolution really took off and started. Then, Wednesday, the communist government resigned.
Incredible. Yeah, that's amazing.
We were 15. We just kind of
that's good.
Along.
That was we were really happy in the West because we were able to drink your beer without without having to tell
pay
us about
inordinate taxes.
Yeah, tell us about Budvar and that story too.
The Budweiser versus the Budweiser. In home we have Budvar, which is the German name for this Budweiser, and the Americans in St. Louis, when they decided they would make beer, which I guess was like in 1850s. Thought, what should we name the beer so everybody understands and remembers the name? Let's name it something that all the German population and all the European population that lives in St. Louis would know. So they said Budweiser is the best beer in the world. Why don't we just call it
even
Budweiser?
Back then, I thought it started with Kraft and Parmesan.
Nope. Even back then. It's a big... And tell the rest of the story is that they...
Well, the Czechs didn't figure it out for about 50 years or 40 years. And when they did, they sued the Americans. And then they did this 100-year-old pact. When the Americans couldn't sell Budweiser in Europe for 100 years, and Czechs couldn't sell their Budweiser in America.
We got the short end.
Yeah, we got the short end of this thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez.
We got screwed on that.
So now Czechoslovakia is that middle country. It's not, is it considered itself Western? It's like the bridge between Eastern and Western Europe a little bit. Is that right?
Well, Czech Republic, which has been split. Like that since 93, which is a very interesting experience too. It was, it was kind of a political decision. The people really didn't like vote on it. It was just the politicians said, okay, we're going to split the country. And on New Year's of 93, next morning, I was living in a different country than where I was born, which was Czech Republic. Mm. But it's right in the middle of Europe. I mean, it's surrounded by Germany, Slovakia.
It's very much the country.
So Slovakia is like the more about the country farmers of the Czech Republic?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, a lot of beautiful mountains, great scenery,
And then they have their own drink, right? Malvasia, is that middle country between, there's the East Czech and West Czech?
Oh, no, Moravia.
Moravia,
which
sorry.
Is where Slivovitz comes from.
That
which
drink,
is something
right?
else, yeah.
Yeah, I heard about that. And how did you come to the States then? What was the reason?
This is a really interesting story. This is how we met, actually, where... I met Peter. You had smuggled tapes from Chechnya when the Chechen right. revolution was going on, and you came to the you came. He was filming on his own because Peter's been.
No, actually,
he's always in the middle.
I was actually
and you came
with
Danny. Go
with the director. Yeah. we had a proper check room. It was my first ever shoot. I don't know what I was doing. But I was working as an assistant in the Czech documentary company. Really, only reason I got the job because I spoke some English. Uh-huh. And one day, this very famous director named Kwasnichka, who was a documentary director, runs in. The door flies open. And he says, "The Russians are in Chechnya. We have to go." And this was in early 95. And the producers looked at him and said, "Okay, relax. Because first of all, how are you going to find the money? And second, who is going to be crazy enough to go with you?" And I was sitting there in the corner and put my hand up and said, "Well, I'll go." And he said, "All right, let's get started." The next thing you know, he found the money and we were in Chechnya. And it was my first ever shoot, which I thought was amazing. So,
and then how did you get to Danny in New York? There was that great story about you, like with the tapes, and you had to smuggle the pornography with the Russian guards and all that. And
if you ever go to war,
bring pornography.
The best bribe is pornographic magazines.
Excellent. That's good to know.
It's pre-internet.
Pre-internet, exactly. And so I somehow got to Danny when I was in New York. I met a friend of mine who met a friend, and she told her that I did this weird film in Chechnya and it was all about human rights. And she put me in touch with Danny Schechter, who had a show called Rights and Wrongs, Human Rights Television.
And they did you, I don't know, did you work on the show? They did a show on Chechnya, but I don't know if you were there at that time. But
originally, they wanted to use a lot of the footage and do an interview with me. And then, of course, like it was too difficult to put it together because Danny was too disorganized. And so they ended up just using some of the footage. But I went in to Global Vision and met Danny.
Right.
And he looked at me and he said, "So what are you doing now?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure. I was just kind of in Miami. Don't have a job. I might have to go back home. My visa are running out." And he said, "Well, there might be something you could do here. Have you?
Yeah.
Can you do sound?" And I kind of scratched my head and said, "Yeah, sure. I can do sound. I've seen a couple guys doing sound." And next thing you know, I got a job and I actually started working with Mark. That's how I met Mark.
Excellent. And we're going to come back in a few minutes, in a few seconds.
And we'll talk about, I don't know, The Amazing Race.
Maybe.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by our friends at Edwards and Sons of Surrey, Virginia. www.surreyfarms.com.
So we're back at the Q Report. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Ed Grant.
Q Report. This is our fifth show. It's
fifth.
No, is it fifth?
I think it's our sixth.
Sixth show, man.
It's pretty. It's like
I can't believe it.
I don't even have butterflies. It's just seamless.
Yeah, it's like this is what we do. We just have microphones in front of us now. This is generally what we usually do anyway. We're here with a special guest, Peter Sickert, who is a director of photography, telling us about this fascinating story, how he came from Prague to New York. And it's really strange, actually, because Peter, even before you came to Global Vision, we kind of knew the same people, oddly, in New York. You know, we were kind of like, you know, circulating in the same circles. And happily, you came to Global Vision. I should mention also that Danny Schechter is a very well-known documentarian, filmmaker, ABC 2020, Emmy-winning, most famously, the News Dissector, for those who are from Boston. He during the 60s and 70s, he was a very famous radio news person. And they had a very prominent series, they being Global Vision and his partner Rory O'Connor, called Rights and Wrongs, which ran for a while. PBS, unfortunately, buried it and at midnight. But in any case,
Jesus. All right, easy, Mark. Sit back down. Yeah.
Stand by.
I won't stand by, Mark.
So, Peter, you went from sound, from pornography to no. Wait, no, just kidding. No, but you did sound, and then did you just then pick up the various aspects of making documentaries and filming, including camera work and lighting and things like that?
Talk about Gary a little bit. Yeah.
Global Vision is this classic New York place where
fantastic.
They do have kind of a niche on finding really talented, young, cool, interesting people. And they didn't pay very much.
Yeah, that's why they want them young.
And but because you know
we're all still in touch though. I mean we're all
friends. Yeah. You know we have this group of you know it's like going to school together. We'll always help each other. Always have each other's back.
Yeah.
And the nice thing you know about it was that you could do things that you were absolutely not qualified to do.
Exactly.
So. I started doing sound. I had really no idea what I was doing. But no one complained, so I kept on doing it. And then one day they said, oh, my God, we need to shoot somebody real quick. Who can we sh-? And I said, I've played around with the camera enough. I'll go shoot it. And I think we shoot it was for a documentary about Dennis Leary.
Yeah.
So that guy.
Dennis Leary. Yeah, it was for Mercury Records.
Right, something like that. So I shot it and looked okay, and they said, okay, well, Peter doesn't cost anything.
Timothy Leary.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say.
Different Leary.
I was like, wow, Global Vision really cutting new trends.
Yeah,
there
no, it was on the opposite. The old hippies, for sure.
Timothy Leary, yeah.
And
so that's how I started. Just started picked the camera.
Yeah.
And went on and really got into it. You know, I always, my philosophy is in life is... every time I have an opportunity, I just try to grab it and run with it and do the best I can. So yeah. When they put camera in my hand, I just figure, hey, I'll do the best thing I can do with this.
Okay, and is that what you've done the most? I mean, since then? Is cameraman how you define yourself?
I would define myself as a cameraman, as a cinematographer. Mm-hmm. I did spend almost a couple years with Gary Griffin, a friend of mine, and I did sound with him because in documentaries, generally the sound man is kind of an assistant and you can learn a lot. And I like to call it the Gary University.
Yeah, he's an Academy Award nominated filmmaker, a very, very prominent. I just watched the documentary.
Great cinematographer.
Yeah, he's very good.
And I picked his brain and learned everything I could. And one day I said, you know what, I think I'm ready to go back to shooting again and see if I can make it on my own. And he didn't talk to me for a year. But
but you're all made up. Your partners
now. We are partners.
Your partners
friends,
now.
So you went from this to now you're an Emmy award-winning cameraman on The Amazing Race.
Also, what a tough job that
twice
would be.
Or once, twice.
Technically, one time.
Did you bring the Emmy with you today?
I did not bring the Emmy. No one told me. I came on a bicycle.
It's radio. It's, come on.
We can say it's here.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah, beautiful, shiny. It's better than a Grammy. And what is it like? Tell us some things about The Amazing Race. What an unbelievable, challenging camera job. Because you're basically running. There's no tripod. There's don't know what's going to happen, right?
I haven't seen a tripod in about 5 years. No, it's basically when you see the those people on the show, they run, you know, for 4 weeks around the world, and I run with them along with a sound man, except that I have 35 pounds on my shoulder. And pretty much what you see them do, we do, you know, more or less. We just have to keep up. We can never slow down.
And you're always recording, right? I mean, is there a time you say, as of 9 a.m. we start and I hit play?
No, it just depends on the show. You have those periods, the mandatory rest period, which is the only time we don't shoot. But whenever they run, we shoot. I mean, obviously, if they're sleeping at a bus station somewhere, I'm sleeping right next to them at a bus station. We were last season. We were in Bucharest, sleeping at a train station, which was particularly rough and quite dirty. But you know, we all slept on the floor. They slept on one side of the room. The crew slept on the other side of the room. I went to a gas station, picked up some cardboard boxes to cover myself with.
And also, part of the rules is that they can't do anything unless they get you. Like if they're awake and you're not, they have to wake you up, right? That's part of the.
They can do whatever they want.
Right.
And it truly is a 100% real show.
Yeah, I can tell.
If I miss a shot and I tell someone, hey, could you go and walk through that door again? I get fired. So if they want to do maybe the bus doesn't go for 9 hours, but they might want to go get a toothpaste at 3 o'clock in the morning. I can't stop them. They just have to tell me, okay, I'm going to get a toothpaste, and I just have to follow them around all night.
Has your team ever won?
I did have the pleasure of bringing a winning team to the home stretch and you know, winning the $1 million.
Which one was that? Or?
This was during the All-Star season, and Eric and Danielle were the two guys.
I have to say, this year, the last season that just wrapped, was the first time that in the final three, I didn't hate at least one of them. Usually there's this one where you're like, don't want them to win, don't want them to win. This year, all the finalists were pretty decent.
They had the filmmaker this year, right? From was that a previous season? I mean, it might be the filmmaker, who did Chuck and Buck.
Oh, no, that was this season. That was he was the scriptwriter.
Yeah.
That was a nice guy.
With his dad.
Yeah, right? His dad. They were both gay.
They were both of them?
Both gay. Yeah,
I know he was, but now, his dad was.
The son, obviously, but, you know.
Is it fair for all people, like if I once saw a midget or someone like very super old, can a very old person win? I mean, isn't it, how much is physical stamina?
Absolutely.
You know, smarts can outwit
physical. I always say the way to lose, and I speak from experience, because when these really buffed up young 23-year-olds make the wrong decision and decide they're going to run 5 kilometers in completely the opposite direction, I have to run after them.
You're
like, and I can't say, hey, you're an idiot. What are you doing? So I always say the way to lose the Amazing Race is to make really stupid decisions really fast. Yeah. And generally, that's what the people who are very buffed up do. And people who are not as...
Are you saying the bigger you are, the dumber you are?
He's just making a general point.
Not saying it.
That doesn't hold true for big camera guys. They're smart.
Exactly. But, you know, there's one thing on the race. The adrenaline and all that, it really does something to your brain. And when you're running and you're just making bad decisions. And normally, if you were in a normal situation, you probably wouldn't.
Well, Peter, thank you. Thank you very much.
I wish we could go another segment, but will you come back on and maybe we talk about other things besides?
We didn't even talk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Could you just give a shout out for the show you just filmed? You know, that's coming up that you shot with Phil.
Oh, it was a very cool project that Phil Kogan, the host of the Amazing Race, did for the last month or so. He was riding a bicycle across America, raising money for MS and raising awareness for just bicycle riding and healthy living and all kinds of other things. And it was really an amazing experience to be with him. And I did the part from Colorado to Iowa. So we went across Nebraska and went to all these tiny little towns, small communities, met all kinds of interesting people, and just had it was really a rewarding experience.
And when will this air?
It's an independent program. I think Phil is going to figure out what to do with it, but you can check all the daily video blogs
which are
philridesacrossamerica.com. It's a very cool thing.
Excellent. Nice.
We'll
we're
going to get we have two complimentary pizzas from Roberta's about to come out, so you know, if you want to stay for
pizza.
Next time.
Perfect. And do you have Budvar? Check Budweiser?
Yeah. Budvar.
It's coming.
Okay, next time I come on.
Hurt now. I can never...
But you prefer Pilsner or Kell or...
I do, but I'm back home. I drink
like
Pilsner or Kell at the pub Urodolfina generally. That's where we end up.
Oh my God. Thanks so much, cool. Peter. Thanks, real honor to have you on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
They did make out in college.
Oh my god. All right. Well,
should
that's a sound effect
that
you might not have heard. But this is the Q Report. I'm here with Mark Marabella.
Hello, everybody.
And Ed Grant.
Hello.
What a fascinating last interview that was. Peter's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he's we'll have him back a lot. We didn't even start with him.
The Amazing Race. I mean, he could talk about each day for an hour.
I mean, we didn't even talk about I just had him hanging out of a helicopter shooting fireworks at him. Like, we didn't even talk about that.
And not little handheld ones, like the real thing. Like
I want to compete in the Amazing Race. Mark, are you down?
I'm with you, Patrick.
Can you get 8 weeks away?
We would argue about which way, which if we should take... Where do we take the cab? You know, the FDR? Or
I think you guys would be great, and I think our friends Sandy and Elisa would also make fantastic television.
That's
because
true.
They'd just
Sandy?
Be like itchy and scratchy, man. They'd just be all over
they
each other.
They might win, though. They could, they have
they
a lot
could
of,
if they got it together, but it would be great TV during the whole run.
We'd be very funny, yeah. But we need maybe a whole team. The whole Q Report airs
that's
on.
That's true.
Well, we're here with actually a first revisit by any guest. Molly Ward,
that's
who
true.
I went to Vassar with. Hey, Molly.
Hi.
Perfect.
And with her two righteous co-stars, Ryder Doyle and Corey Sullivan.
Howdy.
Hello.
Who are in the Noisemakers Apprentice. How's the show been going?
Noisemakers.
You loved this show, didn't you?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
I'm a huge medieval buff. Yeah. Huge. I mean, I wrote my master's thesis on it in graduate school. I do medieval festivals and, you know, food
reenactments.
Reenactments.
You look like the time.
I'm about to get medieval on your ass, by the way. I use that expression.
Grad school, too. The whole thing.
And Molly actually got me into performance studies because she was like, she added three or four sentences that said, we study things through the lens. The lens. So I always owe Molly my gratitude for getting me into that program.
Yeah,
but anyway,
Patrick
the play is absolutely
closet,
great.
He was a closet theory head. Sniffed it out.
I just wanted to follow around the hot girl at college.
That's what I think. Yeah, it's all about getting laid.
Oh, you do do performance? Oh, great. I would love that.
Now, tell us a little bit about the Noisemakers. Noisemakers Apprentice.
I'm going to go.
Okay, I know. Noisemakers Apprentice. It's a story about medieval plastic surgery, about pretty much, right?
Yes, it's sort of a contemporary fairy tale.
And you each play many characters. Molly, I know you play two. Can we hear your 7-year-old girl voice?
Actually, she's 8.
8, all right.
In third grade, actually.
Oh, very good. And now, Ryder, you play actually a few characters, right? Like the assistant and...
I play a couple of assistants, a couple of sidekicks. I play a really gay waiter.
And where is he in France? In gay Paris?
Yeah, he lives in France, but he's actually American. So he works at the Cafe Gruel, and it's sort of his first day every day. A little nervous, a little shaky hand.
And now this is a story, this apprentice actually travels all Europe, so it actually really forces you guys to master a wide range of voices, right? I mean, there's a German time also.
Also across time, too. You guys are doing it.
Time traveling.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty intergalactic.
And now,
yes,
Corey, one of your my favorite voices of yours was the German...
Ulrich. Listen to your hands. He was kind of this like, he was actually pretty straight, just Schwarzenegger plus Werner Herzog. In a nice jumpsuit and some nice socks.
Nature, it
Done.
Is horror and
exactly.
chaos.
And now he was a different German. The guy, the main character you play, or the first character you play, is the host to the young apprentice,
yes,
correct?
Yes, Wulfric.
And he's a very kind of English medieval guy.
He's like the Wulfric son of Arathorn. He just walks around, waves his staff. And
I just, for those who haven't heard the first segment, just tell us a little bit about the story to summarize what it's basically about.
Anyone?
The story is about me, normally, but actually I take a back seat in this one. What is it about? I don't know.
It's about, it's a sort of a contemporary fable about how silly the plastic surgery industry is. Mm-hmm. Anyone?
It's about like a young boy who gets... is the apprentice of a man and who teaches him about how to put fake noses on people to kind of save them from the terrible things that have happened to them, aka war, syphilis, things like that. And then he learns to, I can't give it all away. You're in suspense. But
the, and the little girl comes in, how, tell us.
Well, it's framed as a bedtime story between a plastic, a sort of rogue plastic surgeon and surgeon telling the story to his 8-year-old daughter who wants to know where the history of plastic surgery comes from. So he tells her this elaborate, you know, completely made up fairy tale. And so the play goes back in time and takes us through the fantastical adventures of...
It's like the never-ending story.
It is like the never-ending story,
that's
yeah.
That's very nice. Yeah. Well, we'll talk more when we come back in about 30 seconds.
Okay, great.
So we'll definitely do a plug.
Σε ψηλό βουνό σε ριζιμινιό χαρά.
Are we back? Here at the Q Report. We have the cast from Noses Off.
and
there's some Noises Off. Actually, I'm sorry, the title of the play?
The Nosemaker's Apprentice.
Nosemaker's Apprentice. Thank you, Ed, for correcting
me. Google
it's a hard
it,
room,
say,
actually.
Did you mean Noisemaker's Apprentice?
Friggin' that's Google. That's why we've created our own search engine here at the Heritage Radio Network. Yeah. We don't want to be relying on anyone.
I love that.
Friggin' Google.
Friggin' Google.
Friggin' Google.com.
Did you mean fucking Google? Oh, sorry.
You know, interesting. Okay. I just, if I could segue into... I was thinking about, Patrick, your company, Heritage Foods, that is interested in promoting, you know, rare breeds of animals,
mm-hmm.
You know, keeping them alive and going. And I'm thinking about actors as these sort of farm animals who are looking for someone to keep us alive. And doing this play was...
Rare breed.
we're rare breeds. Mm. And one of the things that I thought was really fun about rehearsing the show was that there was a lot of stuff that got cut.
Hmm.
You know, there was a lot of rewriting that happened on the fly, and with these wonderful actors, Corey Sullivan and Ryder Doyle, among others, there was just a lot of really fun stuff being thrown out there and then mm-hmm. cut and pasted around. And so, I don't know, I thought maybe it'd be fun to have a little family reunion of some of the, like, lovely creatures who we made up in rehearsal who didn't actually make it into the show, or some who did.
Let's hear them. We want to hear about the play. Bengali tigers of Noisemaker.
Ryder, there was a pirate.
My personal favorite character.
The pirate got cut actually so early. In fact, after like the first read through, I mean, you would think that I didn't do a good job with it or something. But I
let's hear him.
But we had the. He's a little Pan Asian, I guess you might say. and he goes, row, 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 rook who divided to row up. and he was in love with Gavin. I think one of the jokes in the play is that the young guy that goes through the story is that most of my characters, almost all of them are in love with him.
Most every character.
Yeah,
so all the characters. My
in real life.
I'm the shepherdess who's
in
love with Gavin. The little girl enters the fairy tale just the way like a little girl reading a fairy tale would want to be the princess in the story. So the little girl character, she becomes Amelia, the young ingenue who loves Gavin, who loves him. But all of these, there's all of these things that come in between her and Gavin, although mm-hmm. they end up together at the end.
I think the only people who aren't in love with him are the kind of gurus, the wizard and the Austrian. I think that's probably because they're pedophiles.
The wizard and the Austrian. Austrian. that's the description. The wizard and the Austrian.
Now, Corey, I know you don't have your chocolate cake, but can you tell us a little bit about the Queen of France?
The overweight, disgusting, smelly king, queen of France.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of she was kind of thrown in there at the last minute. There, we didn't have a lot of time, so I just said, "Get me a cake," and a fat suit, and it will probably be done because it's cheap, but it works.
And what was she like? What were some of the things she wanted from her young apprentice?
Gavin, she wanted from him to slice open her body and suck the fat from it like a glutton sucks the marrow from a bun.
But she never speaks without fudge in her nose and mouth and hair and neck and most places. I pretty much need to do a full sinus clean every night.
He has a picture of Kirsten Dunst in front of his dressing room, and he just sits there and channels her every night. My God.
And we're going to talk. We only have a couple minutes left, but we do have there was this one. So he goes to Germany, this kid from England, to set out on his own. And he meets this really masterful plastic surgeon who's a German. And his one bit of advice to this kid is, and it gets played over, by the way, the PA system numerous times, like as this kid is trying to remember for inspiration. And it's like, remember to use the hands. I thought that was so much because it's more Arnold Schwarzenegger than Saturday Night Live.
I think we have the real thing here.
Okay, so come on, let's hear one last time for old time's sake.
Do not listen to your clients. Do not listen to your colleagues. Do not even listen to me, except for just now when I said, "Listen to your hands."
That is awesome. So, how can people get tickets to your play? You have one more week run, right?
Yeah, three more performances this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Brick Theater in Williamsburg.
Bricktheater.com, is that right, or .org?
That's correct, .com. Mm-hmm.
It's on Lorimer and Metropolitan.
Excellent.
Fantastic. Well, great job, guys.
I think everybody should go and go to the play to see why he should listen to the hand.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's important, and you can see Molly without a nose briefly.
Cool.
Wow. Yeah.
Finally.
Cool. Did I give away anything?
Back with our noses.
Yep.
And thank God.
And our ears is certainly there.
Noises off. Why did I say noses? Noises? Because somebody was. You kept saying noises.
He kept saying noises, but then you brought something completely random in.
Because
the mix.
I started. Because to me, then I started thinking noises off, which
yeah,
is.
Yeah, but you got nose right.
I did. Completely. That's right. So, but Ed, thank that's where you're here, Ed, to keep us straight.
And, yeah.
That was fantastic. So they have three more dates, as Molly said, the 21st, 22nd, 23rd of this month, May. And they've had a pretty successful run.
And you guys should go see it because, as you know, we're taking next week off for Memorial Day. Where are you going, Mark?
I'm going back to the studio. I'm finishing wrapping up shows.
Which show are you wrapping up?
One is called The Earth Without the Moon, which I'll talk about that when it's coming on air for National Geographic. Okay. And two specials and another special called First Life. It's about the origins of life.
Fascinating. I can't wait to do a few skits on that.
That would be God.
Yeah. I actually.
Ed.
Right.
Yes. Ed will not be back with
it's
us.
It's a religious
that creationist
show.
Bastard.
It's an exploration about Genesis.
Yes, the earth is only 6,000 years old.
And Ed, where are you going to be for Memorial Day?
I will be memorializing in Brooklyn. Probably my living room.
Nice.
Sofa. And you're going to the Hamptons, right?
No, I wish. Posh? I'm not even allowed there. They now check your bank account when you get to...
you mean while you're sitting in traffic?
Highway 29. And then we're going to take Memorial Day off, and then we come back. And what are some of the things? I mean, we had a great run of brain segments throughout these past chapter.
A lot more to talk about the brain.
And origins, I bet.
Origins, a lot more people that of all sorts, of all stripes that we've worked with in the documentary world, certainly. And we may be coming up with maybe our first spinoff show, perhaps.
Ooh.
.com. In June with Lorenzo, if he's around. We talk about that.
Well, you've been great to host with Mark. You have the butteriest voice of all.
Buttery, really?
That's what I heard is good. That's what Nat told me is good.
Yeah. Really? What is that? Does that mean I'm clogging
smooth.
People's arteries?
No,
or what does
smooth.
That mean? I'm smooth?
Smooth,
oh, okay.
Like butter.
You're more margarine, Ed.
Yeah, that's fine.
No, but Ed, what do you? What are some of the things you see happening for the Q Report in the coming weeks?
I'm actually working on a little thing about the history of the shipping container.
Yeah,
we're using it. We're all into it. We're in it.
Yeah.
But you know, we really don't know that much about
Patrick,
it.
Patrick, you weren't there, but we were talking about it earlier at brunch, which is we usually have here at lovely Roberta's, and it was fantastic. Actually, it's amazing. It's one of those things that, you know, one of those little items that people don't think about, the box,
yeah,
the shipping container that changed so much in the world and commercial.
And it
industry.
Really affected the waterfront area of Brooklyn and Manhattan,
which is
so
where
there's labor,
yeah,
issues. I mean, the whole, it's fascinating.
Which we're, Ed and I live very close to the Brooklyn Navy, the Brooklyn docks by mm-hmm. Red Hook. So
Navy Yard, where Walt Whitman used to write.
Yes.
Then we have also a bunch of, that should be, you know, tracing things throughout their history, you know, when they first began. And I'm actually very psyched. The head historian for the borough of Brooklyn I met, and he's going to come on for two or three, you know, shows.
Fantastic.
Consecutively.
That
and
is
we could
super,
yeah,
excellent.
Oh my God, there's
pick
so
and
much
choose what we
want,
yeah, to ask.
I want to know about how come the area where I live, Clinton Hill area, used to be like the confectioner's hub of Brooklyn. Like the Union Hall is there. It's like
probably
I live in a chocolate factory.
Yeah, that's right. You know? Probably because the ships could come there and I'm sure it has to do with the water.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, bringing the sugar up.
We were actually in the first show. I don't know if Ed wasn't on the show when we talked about the prison ship.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We're on the show that that was fantastic.
I
mean, it's so amazing.
People
right?
don't know about that. And
yeah,
it's so
like
sad.
It's incredible. Yeah, but that's an incredible story.
And this is a guy who's paid to do that research.
Yeah.
So, and of course, we're always going to cover the major issues like swine flu. We covered this first first few weeks.
Yeah. I think one thing we really want to look into is how big food is doing a full blitz media thing on every front against anything organic, because they're really in small and sustainable because they're freaked out. They're, you know,
good.
Yeah. I heard Michael Pollan
That's
being interviewed
reaction.
Recently, and he was talking about
I heard,
their
yeah.
full press freak out.
I saw
you know?
Him on, he wrote a letter to Obama. He was on, I saw him on Democracy Now, actually.
He
yeah.
was at the Natural History Museum, and he mentioned Heritage Foods as a leader in the sustainable food movement.
As well they are. And thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, I'd like to
a little sad note.
Thank everyone who wrote to me last week on telling their stories of how they got into sustainable food and giving a rat's ass about this.
And sustainable building.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do want to talk more about that.
And if you guys have ideas, our listeners, please
email us.
Mark, M-A-R-K, or Ed, or Patrick at heritageradionetwork.com.
Yeah, we
network
look forward to
networks.
Hearing. Work.
Network. And we're going to also start email blasting show topics on Fridays, so you know people can feel more a part of this.
Yeah, because you know platform. It's a community thing that we want to kind of branch out.
We
I think
elevate.
We might throw down some taste offs with all of our urban gardeners. See who has the best tomato, who has the best eggplant, who has the best pepper. You know, we got to get people into this.
And yeah. I want to have one last thing as a the cheapest meal. Who can make the cheapest meal? And is it 40 cents? Is it 80 cents? You know, that's still decent.
Well, I mean, you'd have to be growing in your backyard, wouldn't you, for the cheapest meal?
Well, you know, you could do something with rice and lemon or
true.
Something. You know, I don't know.
That's
I mean,
true.
Yeah, so that would help.
Yeah, but, definitely.
Well,
and,
thanks,
and
guys.
When we come back from Memorial Day, the garden should be sprouting even more above our heads.
Yep, we'll be eating all we want for free.
It's true.
Free is good.
Yeah.
Free good. All right, well, let's go eat some free pizza, guys.
Yeah, excellent.
Fantastic.
Later.
Regulators. You regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too. But you can't be any geek off the street. Gotta be handy with the steel if you know what I mean. Earn your keep.